Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take the crucial insights from the world's most informed sources and deliver them straight to you. I'm Jamie Murdoch, your guide, and I'm ready to unpack the complex, the surprising, and, well, the absolutely essential stories defining our moment.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse. Our mission here is really to synthesize this complex information thoroughly, connect those crucial dots, and ensure you walk away not just knowledgeable, but expertly informed about the current global landscape.
Our deep dive today is pretty comprehensive. We're spanning global geopolitical flashpoints, the tumultuous domestic situation in the U.S., everything from monetary policy to political violence, major shifts in finance and the future of tech and work, and finally some critical social and cultural developments. This is our deep dive into The Economist for the week of September 20th to 26th, 25. Okay, let's start with probably the most volatile situation globally right now, the Middle East. The Gaza war, it seems, has moved into a new, really critical phase.
That's right. The Israel Defense Forces, according to the latest reports, have gained control of widespread parts of Gaza City. That's a major step in their long-expected ground assault.
And the aim there is defeating the remaining Hamas fighters, something like 3,000.
That's the stated military goal, yeah. Defeating those fighters operating in that very dense urban environment. But the human cost... well, it remains catastrophic.
How many civilians are we talking about still in the city?
Reports indicate around 600,000 civilians are still trapped within Gaza City. Many, have already been displaced multiple times since this conflict began. It's just devastating.
And amidst all this, we saw U.S. politicians getting involved directly.
Yes. Senator Marco Rubio met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem. They were specifically discussing what the future political and security structure of Gaza might look like.
So even while the fighting is intense, the U.S. is already trying to figure out the day after.
Desperately trying to shape it, yes. Which brings us really to the core strategic insight from the source material this week. The U.S.-Israel alliance, it seems to be genuinely cracking.
Cracking? That sounds serious. For Israel, losing U.S. popular support must be... potentially catastrophic, right? A country of 10 million in such a hostile neighborhood.
Exactly. And the most concrete measure of this stress is probably that military aid agreement. It's $3.8 billion a year, but it's set to run out in 2028.
And the fear is it might not be renewed, even under Trump.
That's the palpable concern in Israeli diplomatic circles, yes. They fear a situation where even President Trump might refuse to renew the package. He might push for a technology partnership instead.
But technology partnership, how is that different from aid?
It's fundamentally different. Aid is guaranteed income, basically. It funds their security doctrine. A technology partnership, though, it shifts Israel from being a guaranteed security recipient to more of a transactional market participant.
So they'd have to compete commercially for security tech.
Precisely. It fundamentally alters the bedrock of that decades-long alliance. It's a huge potential shift.
And what's really striking is where the dissent in the U.S. is coming from. It's not just one side, is it?
No, it's coming from both ends of the political spectrum almost simultaneously. On the right, you're seeing the rise of this isolationist, America-only MAGAO shift.
People like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson.
Right. They're now openly campaigning against the alliance. Their argument is that Israel is dragging the U.S. into expensive foreign entanglements and hoovering up resources that should be used domestically.
That's a major break from traditional Republican stances.
A fundamental break. And meanwhile, the shift on the Democratic side is accelerating just as quickly.
Yeah, the reporting suggests Jewish Americans, who are mostly Democrats, feel the Israeli government's actions really clash with their core liberal values.
Uh-huh. And you see groups like J Street, which advocate for a more liberal, pro-Israel stance.
Mm.
Their operating budget has apparently jumped over 50% in the last 4 years. That reflects this pivot.
And it's not just younger Democrats.
Is it? Even older, traditionally supportive Democrats are losing what the source calls that romantic vision of Israel as a plucky underdog. That image seems to be gone, replaced by the reality of military occupation and the humanitarian crisis.
So with this growing isolation, what's happening internationally? Other countries are stepping in.
Well, America still holds that crucial UN Security Council veto, which prevents Israel from becoming a total global pariah. But several of its closest Western allies are planning action.
Who are we talking about?
Specifically Australia, the UK, Canada, and France. They're reportedly planning to formally recognize a Palestinian state during the current UN General Assembly session.
Right. And here's that bizarre, painful disconnect you mentioned earlier. The world talks about recognizing a state at the UN, but on the ground.
On the ground, the very concept seems to be dissolving. Ramallah, which was meant to be the administrative showcase of the Palestinian Authority, it's now described as feeling like a Potemkin village.
A Potemkin village? So just a facade?
Exactly. An impressive front hiding a grim reality. And the economic reality in Ramallah is devastating. That's largely due to the ongoing economic war being waged by Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich.
Can you detail that economic warfare for us? What's happening with the PA's funds?
Well, Smotrich has stopped the transfer of customs revenues. These are funds the PA relies on under agreements negotiated decades ago. Without them, the Palestinian Authority has had to make absolutely draconian cuts.
Like what kind of cuts?
Employee salaries have been halved, sometimes more. School openings have been delayed. Functionaries are reportedly instructed to work only a two-day week. It's deliberate economic pressure designed to cripple the very foundations of any state structure.
And this ties into Smotrich's broader political vision for the West Bank.
Directly. The sources highlight his vision map, which apparently shows Israel controlling all but about 18% of the West Bank. It reduces Palestinian cities to basically six stranded islands, surrounded by Israeli military control and settlements.
So annexation isn't just a future threat. It's happening now, by stealth.
That seems to be the implication. And we also saw the final approval for expanding the E1 settlement block. That involves building, initially, around 3,400 homes.
And E1 is strategically significant, right?
Hugely significant. It physically severs the northern West Bank from the southern West Bank. If that's built out, any contiguous, viable Palestinian state becomes, well, practically impossible.
Okay, switching back to the military campaign itself in Gaza City, what about the hostage crisis? That's still ongoing.
It is, and it's incredibly tense. The IDF chief, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, has reportedly warned the Israeli cabinet that achieving a decisive total victory against Hamas could easily take years.
Years. And what does that mean for the hostages? There's still 20 held, aren't there?
Yes, 20 remaining. And this prolonged military effort significantly jeopardizes their safety, their lives. The families are becoming increasingly vocal.
We saw protests.
Yes, anguish protests outside Netanyahu's home. Relatives were openly accusing the prime minister of valuing the military objective over their children's lives, effectively accusing him of choosing to kill their children by continuing this maximalist assault. That's a severe political liability for Netanyahu domestically.
And this tension is spilling over regionally, too.
Absolutely. Arab states gathered recently in Doha. They issued a unified condemnation of Israel's recent failed attempt to assassinate Hamas leaders who were operating within Qatar.
That must have been a wake-up call for the Gulf states.
A major one, yeah. Mm. Especially regarding their own joint security. Those wealthy Gulf states, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they're looking for a firm response now.
What are they demanding?
They're putting immense pressure on America, demanding a more formal U.S. security guarantee against this kind of unilateral Israeli action.
Which forces a difficult choice for President Trump.
Exactly. Does he side with his lucrative alliances with the wealthy Gulf states who provide stability and capital? Or does he maintain his self-proclaimed no-limits friendship with Netanyahu? It puts the U.S. security guarantee right at the center of that choice.
Okay. Let's leave the intense volatility of the Middle East there for a moment and pivot to some other challenges, first in Europe and Africa. What's happening in Ukraine?
Well, the pressure is definitely mounting on Kyiv's leadership. Two senior Ukrainian officers were reportedly sacked recently.
Sacked for what?
For failing to prevent significant Russian territorial gains. One area was in the Zaporizhia region, and another was an area bordering the Donetsk and Dnipropetrovsk regions.
Mm. That suggests some serious operational scrutiny within the Ukrainian command.
It certainly confirms the difficulty they're having holding the line against superior Russian firepower and manpower. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Russia, we finally have confirmation regarding the death of Alexei Navalny.
Confirmation. I thought we knew he died back in February 2024.
We knew he died, yes. But now there's definitive clarity on the cause of death. His wife, Yulia Navalnaya, managed to successfully smuggle biological samples out of Russia.
And testing confirmed.
Testing confirmed it was indeed due to poisoning. So that removes any final ambiguity about the Russian opposition leader's fate. It places it firmly in the realm of state-sanctioned political assassination.
Grim. Okay, moving south to Romania, there's political turmoil there.
Intense turmoil, yes. Prosecutors have charged Calin Georgescu. He was the guy who narrowly won the first round of the presidential election last November before his victory was annulled.
Annulled over Russian interference concerns, right?
Exactly. Concerns that Russia provided significant material support to his campaign. Now he's been charged with plotting a coup. It really underscores that persistent shadow of Russian interference, especially along his borders.
Trying to destabilize things. And finally, tragic news from Africa.
Yes, from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Over 200 people died, and another 100 are still missing after two separate boat accidents.
That's horrific. What happened?
One single vessel, reportedly carrying almost 500 people, capsized after catching fire on the Congo River. It just highlights the massive safety risks and, you know, the chronic overcrowding in transport infrastructure in many parts of the region.
And just quickly, elections in Malawi.
Yes, elections there were heavily dominated by the rising cost of food. That's such a familiar crisis point across much of Africa right now. The presidential contest looks like it's heading to a runoff.
Between the incumbent and his predecessor.
That's right. Lazarus Chakwera and Peter Mutharika. It really shows how fragile economic stability is when elections hinge primarily on the price of basic necessities.
All right, let's bring our focus back home to the U.S. because there's plenty of volatility here, too, starting with the economy and the huge domestic pressures, especially around the Federal Reserve.
Indeed. The Fed cut interest rates for the first time this year, just a small cut, a quarter of a percentage point, bringing the benchmark down to 4.25%.
And this was despite intense political pressure from President Trump, wasn't it? He wanted bigger, faster cuts.
He did. And the politics surrounding the Fed's independence are, frankly, at a perilous level right now. We saw a really stark example with Steven Mnuchin.
Trump's nominee for the Fed board.
Correct. He was approved by the Senate incredibly quickly, like super swiftly, specifically so he could be seated just in time to vote at this last meeting.
And what did he do at the meeting?
He immediately dissented. Argued for a half-point cut, exactly what Trump wanted. It signals a very clear attempt to install politically aligned figures who might prioritize short-term stimulus over the Fed's mandate for stability.
Okay, let's unpack the economic reasons for the rate cut, because it sounds complicated. The main argument was weak jobs data.
That's the headline argument, yes. Firms created an average of only 27,000 jobs per month since May. That sounds weak.
But you're arguing that might be a misleading indicator of a cooling economy.
I think we need to connect it to the broader context of U.S. domestic policy. That slowdown in hiring might not actually reflect a cold economy or flagging demand. It could reflect a dramatically shrinking labor supply.
Because of the immigration clampdown.
Exactly. The massive immigration clampdown under the Trump administration is really starting to bite. Some researchers are now projecting that net migration this year could actually be negative. That's a huge swing from historical norms.
So fewer people entering the workforce means fewer jobs created, even if demand is still there.
That's the alternative explanation. And look, the unemployment rate is still only 4.3%. That doesn't exactly scream economy in desperate need of stimulus.
So if the weakness is supply-driven, cutting rates based on that data could be risky.
It could risk making monetary policy too loose, yeah. Potentially fueling inflation or asset bubbles, especially since retail sales and service sector sentiment are still surprisingly strong. And the stock market is, well, pretty euphoric, mostly thanks to AI optimism.
So it's a real split decision, a disagreement over whether the economy is supply constrained or demand constrained.
Fundamentally, yes. That's the core debate driving the Fed's actions right now.
Okay, shifting from economics to law enforcement. We're seeing increasing talk and action on the militarization of American cities.
Yes. President Trump has deployed National Guard troops in Washington, D.C., Memphis, and New Orleans. Ostensibly, the reason given is to fight crime. The visuals are certainly striking.
Striking, but how effective are they? What are they actually doing?
Well, functionally, they're quite limited. In D.C., for instance, the National Guard troops are largely restricted to collecting rubbish and spreading mulch near landmarks.
Collecting rubbish. Critics must be calling it a political stunt.
They are, quickly labeling it a political stunt. But it's a stunt that plays extremely well to a base demanding visible action on crime.
But why are they limited to collecting trash? Why can't they actually police the streets?
Ah, that's where the legal framework gets critical. Specifically, the Posse Comitatus Act, PCA.
Passed way back when?
1878. The PCA generally restricts the use of the U.S. military, and that includes the National Guard when they're federally deployed from performing civilian police work. Things like search, seizure, or arrest.
So that's why they're doing menial tasks. Has Trump considered overriding that?
He has avoided so far invoking the Powder Keg Insurrection Act that would temporarily override the PCA and empower soldiers to detain and arrest people. But invoking it carries immense political and legal risks.
But the deployment isn't just symbolic, is it? There were also federal agents deployed in D.C.
Correct. 500 federal agents who can make arrests were also sent in. President Trump boasts that this likely contributed to a decline in crime.
Is there evidence for that?
We need to contextualize that claim. Crime analysts point out that violent crime in D.C. was actually already falling by about 35% compared to the previous year, so the deployment might have accelerated an existing trend rather than starting one.
And what's the impact on city life itself?
Well, this heavy, visible police and military presence seems to have a chilling effect on just the normal, mundane aspects of city life. Reports mention reduced foot traffic, fewer bike trips, and even international tourism cooling off. It replaces a sense of spontaneity with a sense of security, maybe?
And there's a legal challenge to this, particularly in California.
Yes, this is crucial. Trump deployed troops there over Governor Newsom's objections. The administration is now arguing in court that the PCA might not fully apply to these specific operations.
And even more worryingly.
Even more dangerously, they're arguing that courts cannot second-guess the president's assessment of a security threat. If the administration wins that argument, it massively broadens executive power to unilaterally deploy military forces domestically. A huge deal.
Okay, next, we absolutely must discuss the profound fallout following the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk.
Yes. The charged suspect, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, was reportedly motivated by political reasons. He apparently expressed progressive activism and stated he had enough of Kirk's hatred.
And the political response was immediate.
Instantaneous and intensely polarized. Vice President Vance and President Trump immediately blamed the radical left. Vance even cited YouGov polls.
The polls claiming liberals are more supportive of political violence.
That's the one. Claiming 25% of very liberal Americans support political violence as sometimes justified, compared to just 3% of very conservative Americans.
But polling on violence is notoriously tricky, isn't it? Especially the timing?
It raises serious methodological questions. Crucially, that specific poll was conducted immediately following Kirk's murder. Academic research shows partisans are far more likely to describe political violence as a widespread problem right after an attack on their side. It temporarily inflates the perceived support among the opposition.
So the numbers might be skewed by the event itself.
Very likely. If you look at broader data sets like the Prosecution Project, which tracks felony cases involving political violence, while extremists on both sides commit violence, more incidents and often higher levels of planning tend to come from right-leaning attackers. The immediate reaction and selective use of that poll data seem more about solidifying political narratives than reflecting a stable reality.
And in response to Kirk's killing, the MAGA world launched a campaign against nonprofits.
A highly targeted campaign against progressive nonprofits, yes. The Department of Education proposed a new rule.
What does the rule do?
It would deny federal student loan forgiveness to graduates working for nonprofits if that nonprofit is deemed to have a substantial illegal purpose.
Substantial illegal purpose. That sounds incredibly broad.
It is extremely broad, and it seems designed to create a vast gray area targeting progressive activism. The definition could cover services like helping undocumented immigrants, providing transgender health care, or even engaging in pipeline protests.
So for nonprofits relying on graduates needing loan forgiveness, this is a huge threat.
A massive headache and a potential recruitment killer. If graduates can't get their loans forgiven working for you, it makes it much harder to attract talent.
The goal seems to be a chilling effect on free speech, threatening their workforce and maybe even their tax status.
Precisely. Advisors are reporting widespread anxiety, a lot of website scrubbing. Nonprofits are deleting explicit DEI language, conducting mock audits, anticipating IRS scrutiny, even if the legal basis for yanking tax exemption seems dubious.
So it's weaponizing administrative rules to suppress political opposition.
That appears to be the strategic intent, yes.
And that weaponization brings us right to the debate over DEI on campus. Trump is targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion frameworks, but also doing things that look like DEI.
It's a textbook contradiction, really. While dismantling DEI broadly, he's simultaneously instituting highly specific measures. For example, directing Columbia University to hire an additional administrator specifically for Jewish life to address rising anti-Semitism.
Which sounds exactly like a DEI initiative.
It acts exactly like a DEI framework. It provides bespoke administrative support and advocacy for a specific vulnerable group. Jewish students who felt the existing broader framework wasn't protecting them adequately. The issue isn't the principle of support itself, but the selective application and dismantling based on political favor.
And the danger in all this is using broad definitions, like the one for anti-Semitism, as a kind of speech code.
Yes, exactly. The definition being pushed aggressively as a campus speech code. Well, it was drafted by Ken Stern 21 years ago, primarily to track hate crimes in Europe.
And Stern himself opposes using it this way now.
Passionately argues against its use on campus. He says its breadth risks censoring legitimate speech and stifling the very academic debate that's vital to education.
And the consequence of this atmosphere.
It's reflected in some alarming polling. 34% of students reportedly find it acceptable to use violence to stop a speaker on campus. That shows a serious breakdown in the understanding of free speech principles.
You know, what's fascinating about all these conflicts, the selective use of power, the polarization around the Fed, the disputed reality of political violence, is how they seem to connect to that idea of trust and shared reality. It almost sounds like a breakdown in, what was it, common knowledge.
That's a really powerful connection. Yeah. If the stability of our whole system relies on us all kind of knowing what everyone else knows and accepting the basic rules of engagement, then what happens when institutional facts like, are cities safe? Is the Fed neutral? What's the reality of political violence? When those become highly contested, politically weaponized.
Then that common knowledge breaks down.
It frays. It breaks down. We're witnessing the fraying of shared reality itself.
Okay, let's shift our gaze now to global markets. Starting with what sounds like a savage economic face-off in the car industry, and it's all being driven by China.
Savage is a good word for it. The Chinese EV market is caught in a truly destructive price war. And the root cause, chronic overcapacity.
How bad is the overcapacity?
It's enormous. China's factories right now are basically set up to churn out roughly twice as many cars as there are actual domestic buyers. This structural mismatch has led to hyper-competition, sometimes called involution.
And that's driving prices down dramatically.
Yeah, plummeting. The average car price in China has fallen by a staggering 19% in just 2 years. 19%.
Wow. That kind of internal competition must be absolutely squeezing foreign players out.
It absolutely is. Chinese domestic brands now dominate their home market, holding a formidable 69% market share. Foreign manufacturers think Ford, GM, Nissan. They're finding they just cannot compete in a sustained price war against local players who are often subsidized by regional governments and built on massive scale.
So they're being pushed out of the world's biggest car market.
Effectively, yes. So if these Chinese firms can't sell all their cars domestically, where do they look?
Outward, exports.
Exactly. Those Chinese firms, you know, honed by that ruthless competition at home, are now using exports to seek fatter profit margins internationally. China is now the world's largest car exporter.
How many cars are we talking about?
Nearly 3.5 million cars shipped in just the first half of 2025 alone. They are aggressively penetrating the European market, making significant inroads even despite the EU's attempts to curb them with new tariffs. This is going to fundamentally reshape global auto manufacturing.
Okay, moving from manufacturing to the high-tech frontier, let's talk about the explosive growth in India's AI market. It's now the second largest market for OpenAI and Anthropic.
Second largest globally, yes. It's a prime example of what they call blitzscaling tactics by the Silicon Valley giants.
Blitzscaling, meaning?
Meaning attempting to lock in massive user bases really early on by offering ridiculously low prices. For example, OpenAI is reportedly selling access to a high-end chatbot in India for just 1/5 of the price of its cheapest American plan.
So the goal is market dominance first, profits later.
That's the long-term play. Lock in the users now, even if margins are thin initially.
And India itself is uniquely shaping how the AI technology develops.
It really is. Because of various literacy challenges and just user preference, voice interaction rather than text, has quickly emerged as the dominant way people interact with AI tools there.
So Indian users are forcing developers to prioritize voice.
They're forcing developers to prioritize and perfect voice capabilities, yeah. And that will eventually trickle down globally. India's aim is to leverage this unique user environment to become an exporter of frugal, scalable innovation, much like they did successfully with their India Stack digital public platform.
Okay, this AI boom leads us straight into a really interesting, maybe slightly concerning, accounting puzzle. A $4 trillion puzzle at the heart of the AI cloud giants.
It is concerning, potentially, and it's absolutely critical for understanding their current reported profitability. It all revolves around depreciation.
Depreciation, that's how companies account for assets losing value over time, right?
Exactly. How they write down the value of those massively expensive AI chips, the GPUs that power these large language models.
So what's the puzzle? What's the conflict?
Well, NVIDIA, the main chip maker, is updating its hardware basically every year. That means the chips can become technologically obsolete pretty quickly, maybe within 3 years. Yet the major cloud players, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Oracle, they've recently extended the estimated useful life of these AI chips for accounting purposes.
To how long?
To 5 or even 6 years.
Okay, why does stretching out the useful life matter so much for their profits?
Because depreciation spreads the cost of an asset over that useful life. So if a chip costs, say, $100 and you depreciate it over 3 years, you deduct roughly $33 a year from your profits. But if you extend that life to 6 years, you only deduct about $16 a year.
Ah, so less expense showing up on the books today means higher reported profits today.
Precisely. It artificially boosts current recorded profits. Analysts estimate that if the true economic life of these servers is closer to 3 years because they become outdated so fast, then the combined annual pre-tax profit of the big five cloud companies could fall by a staggering $26
billion. $26
billion. Or about 8% of last year's total profit for those five companies combined. It's a material risk potentially hidden in optimistic accounting practices.
Wow. Okay, moving from high finance to labor. China's gig economy. The numbers are just huge. 200 million workers.
200 million gig workers. That's something like 40% of their entire urban labor force. The scale is immense.
And that includes manufacturing, too.
Yes, including 40 million casual workers just in manufacturing alone. That number is more than 3 times the size of America's entire manufacturing workforce. These workers are the backbone of China's economic output, but their lives are incredibly precarious.
And part of that precariousness comes from China's residency system, the Hukou system.
Yes, the Hukou system plays a huge role. It's China's internal residency permit system. It essentially restricts where people can legally settle and access state-provided services like schooling, healthcare, pensions.
So these gig workers, mostly migrants from rural areas, they can't really settle down in the cities where they work.
They struggle to settle permanently, yes, which denies them and their families access to crucial urban services. This lack of security creates long-term societal risks beyond just the economic instability for the workers themselves.
Well, but what kind of risks?
Well, this lack of security, coupled with difficulty acquiring new skills, it poses long-term risks to things like marriage and fertility rates. And that just compounds China's already severe population aging problem.
So what's the global lesson here for other governments watching the rise of the gig economy everywhere?
I think the lesson is twofold. First, manufacturing just isn't the guaranteed job stabilizer it once was. Automation, the de-skilling of roles. Many factory jobs are temporary or rely on workers who only need very basic task knowledge.
And the second lesson?
Second, it seems fundamentally futile for governments to try and stamp out gig work entirely. A recent survey mentioned that 77% of ride-hailing drivers entered the industry after losing their previous jobs. For most of them, the alternative to gig work is often, well, no work at all. It provides necessary elasticity, flexibility to the labor market.
Right. Okay, let's look briefly at corporate governance. President Trump is proposing a shift in earnings reports.
Yes, moving from quarterly earnings reports every 3 months to semi-annual reporting, so every 6 months. His argument is that this would curb short-termism.
The idea that CEOs focus too much on the next quarter's results instead of long-term strategy.
That's the argument. And the SEC is reportedly considering it more favorably this time compared to his first term. However, the source material argues that this concern over short-termism is actually quite flimsy.
Why flimsy?
Because long-term investment is not only possible, but it's often handsomely rewarded on U.S. markets. We see firms like Oracle announcing huge cloud computing contracts that won't even kick in until 2027. More reporting, more transparency, while it does consume corporate time, fundamentally reduces investor risk. Reducing it could actually be a step backward for capital allocation.
Interesting. Okay, staying with management, there's this age-old question about span of control. How many people should a manager directly manage?
Ah, yes, the span of control. Historically, you had thinkers like Henri Fayol suggesting fewer than 6 direct reports. And we often hear that myth of 7 ±2.
That's a myth.
It's derived from unrelated short-term memory research, apparently not actual management science. The real answer today is always Well, it depends.
Depends on what?
On the complexity of the tasks, the company culture, the talent level of the employees themselves, and crucially, the support provided by technology, things like AI-assisted communication tools, Slack, and so on.
So there's no magic number. But is there a practical baseline, maybe?
Experts suggest that for most modern, flatter organizations, a baseline range is probably somewhere between 12 to 15 direct reports. Too few, and you get bogged down in too many layers, bureaucracy. Too many, and the manager just gets overwhelmed.
Unless you're the CEO of NVIDIA.
Right, unless you're Jensen Huang, who reportedly has more than 50 direct reports. Which just goes to show that in unique, high-performing cultures, sometimes the standard rules don't apply.
Okay, finally in this section, let's discuss this compelling argument from Thomas Phillipson about drug development and what he calls the global free rider problem.
It's a powerful argument. He points out that the U.S. accounts for something like 70% of all the profits made on patented medicines within the OECD countries. 70%.
Meaning the U.S. is effectively subsidizing global drug R&D.
That's the core of it. The U.S. market shoulders the burden for the incredibly risky, incredibly expensive, often $2 billion plus R&D efforts that benefit the whole world. Europe, by contrast, tends to aggressively suppress prices and restrict access.
How do they restrict access?
Through stringent cost-effectiveness evaluations. For instance, the UK's NHS values an additional year of healthy life at only about £20,000, £30,000.
Which is much lower than in the US.
Far below the $100,000, $150,000 valuations commonly used in the US. This difference has real-world consequences.
What are they?
It means the UK and other European nations demand steep discounts. They limit patient access to innovative new drugs. And that undercuts the financial incentives needed globally to sustain R&D investment for the next generation of Medisaves. They're effectively free riding on America's willingness to pay high prices.
And the proposed solution is quite striking, using NATO's defense spending model.
As a template, yeah. The idea is that European countries should adopt minimum spending targets specifically for innovative medicines, maybe matching the U.S. share, which is nearly 0.8% of per head GDP spent on new drugs.
Does that mean Europe needs to spend more overall on healthcare?
Not necessarily more in total, but spend smarter. They could raise reimbursements for the truly cutting-edge innovative drugs, while at the same time increasing their use of cheaper generic therapies. Paradoxically, generics are often more expensive in Europe than in the U.S.
So shift spending towards innovation, use generics more efficiently.
Exactly. That could spur global R&D and maybe diffuse some of the political tensions, especially with the current U.S. administration's push on drug pricing, which could be mutually destructive if not handled carefully.
All right, let's move into our final section, looking at social issues, public health, and some interesting cultural debates. First, a complex and politically sensitive topic, gender identity stability. We're referencing the 7-year trans youth project here.
Yes, led by Dr. Christina Olson. The primary finding from this long-term study is pretty significant. It found that 82% of the children studied who socially transitioned at an average age of about 6.5 retained a stable gender identity over the 7-year period of the study.
So for the majority, their identity remained consistent after transitioning socially early on.
That's what the longitudinal data suggests, yes. It provides strong support for the idea that for most of these children, their identity is stable.
But the conversation and the controversy often focuses on the remaining 18%, doesn't it?
It does. That 18% experienced a change. They either re-identified with their sex assigned at birth or settled on a non-binary identity. This certainly points to the need for careful, non-rush diagnosis and ongoing support.
But there was another finding that critics often seize upon, related to external influences.
Yes. Critics of the medical intervention model often highlight a secondary finding concerning siblings.
What did that finding show?
It found that 23% of the female siblings of the trans children in the study also became trans-identified themselves during the study period.
23%. That sounds high compared to the general population.
It is a much higher rate than observed in the non-sibling control group. And critics point out that this coincides with the rapid, recent rise we've seen in young people identifying as transgender, especially among natal females.
So the interpretation here is split.
Very much so. The original study authors expressed skepticism that this is strong evidence of, say, peer influence or social contagion. But critics suggest it points towards the significant role that external social factors, maybe family dynamics or shared environments, might play in the development or expression of gender identity. It really highlights the political and scientific nuance surrounding intervention pathways.
Okay, shifting gears to public health, Let's challenge some standard medical advice about the sun. New research suggests maybe we shouldn't be avoiding it quite so aggressively.
It does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? But provided you avoid actually getting sunburned, new research is correlating moderate UV exposure with a lower risk of death from all causes, something like 12-15% lower risk.
Wow. How does that work? What's the mechanism?
The benefit is believed to be linked to the release of nitric oxide. UV light triggers its release via a skin pathway, and nitric oxide is known to offer protection against heart disease.
So Dr. Richard Weller, one of the researchers, argues the benefits might outweigh the risks for many people.
He does, especially for people living in gloomy, high-latitude countries where UV exposure is scarce for large parts of the year. This research also fits with broader epidemiological data, things like blood pressure tending to rise the farther you move from the equator, and heart disease death rates peaking in winter.
Is this changing public health advice anywhere?
Even Australia, which is known for its very aggressive anti-sun messaging because of high skin cancer rates, is reportedly tweaking its public health guidance now. They're trying to account for these potential systemic benefits and also differences related to skin pigmentation.
Interesting. Okay, let's move to what sounds like a profound social crisis in South Africa, fatherlessness. The statistics are stark.
They really are. Only 36% of children in South Africa live with their biological father. And for Black children, that figure drops to a deeply concerning 31%. That's a significant decline since the end of apartheid.
What's driving this trend?
It seems deeply rooted in history, culture, and ongoing economic stagnation. Historically, under apartheid, Black men were often forcibly recruited to work far from their families in things like all-male mine hostels.
And even though apartheid ended,
the economic structure didn't radically change fast enough to reverse that legacy. Plus, women's increased financial independence, partly through reliable child support grants, has made it financially more feasible for mothers to live apart from the fathers of their children, even if it's not always ideal.
Are there efforts underway to address this?
Yes, civil society groups are stepping in. Groups like Father A Nation and Heartlines are actively promoting what they call positive masculinity.
How do they do that?
They run mentorship programs, they produce media. There's even a popular Sesame Street puppet named Zikwe designed for this. The goal is to encourage fathers to be present, involved, and emotionally available in their children's lives. It's a real attempt to culturally shift the perception and practice of paternal responsibility.
Okay, turning to the environmental front, but with an economic twist, the emergence of a new petrostate, Guyana.
Yes. Following President Irfan Ali's election win, Guyana, a country with only about 830,000 people, is on track to produce more oil per inhabitant than basically anywhere else in the world.
The reserves are huge, aren't they?
Estimated recoverable barrels are around 11 billion. Oil revenues are projected to hit $10 billion annually by 2030. That's an immense, potentially transformative amount of money for such a tiny country.
But that brings the risk of the resource curse.
Absolutely. That classic challenge where resource-rich nations often fail to translate that wealth into broad, stable economic prosperity. Reasons range from corruption, poor governance, to just overdependence on that single commodity.
Are they taking steps to avoid that?
It's encouraging, yes. They are taking steps. They've set up a sovereign wealth fund, for example.
Getting advice from Norway.
Exactly. Seeking advice from Norway, which manages the world's largest sovereign wealth fund.
Yeah.
Guyana's fund is already valued at around $3.6 billion. So they're trying.
But this wealth is causing friction.
It's generating geopolitical complications, yes. Notably from neighboring Venezuela, which has this long-standing territorial claim over a large resource-rich part of Guyana. The U.S. is making its support for Guyana clear, though they flew two military jets over Ali's inauguration ceremony. A very visible show of force.
Right. Okay. In a contrasting environmental story, let's talk about coral reefs.
Yeah.
Colombia is pioneering something called coral IVF.
Yes, in Santa Marta. It's an effort to combat coral bleaching, which has been devastating. The Caribbean has lost over 50% of its coral since the 1970s due to rising sea temperatures and other stressors.
So what exactly is coral IVF? How does it work?
It's a really crucial hands-on restoration effort. Biologists are literally assisting reef reproduction. They collect coral eggs and sperm during spawning events, perform fertilization in lab settings, and then carefully transplant the resulting tiny coral hatchlings back onto the reef.
And the goal isn't just replacing what was lost, but making the reef stronger.
Exactly. It's not just about quantity. by preserving a maximum possible genetic diversity and specifically selecting hardier, more heat-resistant coral varieties, they hope to create a reef ecosystem that's better adapted to survive in warmer oceans.
Is it expensive?
Actually, this form of restoration is comparatively affordable. It costs about $36,000 per hectare, which is roughly a third of the regional average for other reef restoration methods, so it offers hope.
Okay, finally, let's circle back to something we touched on earlier and really dive into psychology and culture, focusing on Steven Pinker's analysis of common knowledge. He uses the fable of the Naked Emperor.
That's right. Pinker defines common knowledge brilliantly. It's not just knowing a fact. It's knowing that everyone else knows that fact and knowing that they know that you know it and so on. It's this recursive shared awareness.
And this shared awareness is what drives large-scale social action?
It drives all large-scale coordination and social action, according to Pinker. It explains why something like fiat currency paper money has value. It only has value because we all agree it has value, and crucially because we know everyone else agrees it has value.
We're thinking back a few years, why people panic bought toilet paper at the start of COVID.
Exactly. People weren't necessarily worried that the supply chains themselves would collapse completely. They were reacting to the common knowledge that everyone else was going to panic buy. That forced even rational actors to join the panic just to make sure they got some before it was gone.
Applying this concept to things like violence and advertising makes some social pressures startlingly clear.
Take interpersonal violence, for example. Pinker argues that sometimes young men might resort to violence over seemingly trivial insults. Why? Because publicly backing down in a situation where everyone knows you were challenged and chose safety, well, that invites inevitable bullying and a loss of status. The violence is often performed to reestablish the common knowledge that they are not someone to be messed with.
And advertisers exploit this understanding of common knowledge perfectly.
Oh, absolutely. Think about Super Bowl ads. They're effective, not just because millions of people see them, you could probably get cheaper reach elsewhere. They're effective because of the common knowledge that everyone knows millions saw them.
So the ads work for brands people want others to think are cool.
Exactly. Brands people want others to think are cool, like luxury cars. Or products whose value actually depends on widespread use, like a new social media platform. The ad reinforces the shared social script around that product or brand.
And we even see this kind of high-stakes common knowledge playing out in pop culture. You mentioned the resurgence of the love triangle trope.
Yes, like in the show The Summer I Turned Pretty. The premise is simple girl torn between two brothers, but the show's popularity is immense. It topped Amazon's global charts and specifically attracted a huge audience of adult women, aged 25 to 54.
And the common knowledge generated by everyone watching leads to intense online behavior.
It leads to an intense shared online reality. The fan behavior is extreme. Viewers fiercely align themselves publicly, Team Conrad or Team Jeremiah. There's intense online dissection of every scene, every glance. There were even reports of insults being hurled at the actors themselves online. It really demonstrates how shared culture can generate this intense common knowledge that almost demands emotional adherence to a specific public opinion within that fandom. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. We have certainly covered some intense global volatility this week, from the political weaponization of the Federal Reserve and that deep crisis fracturing U.S.-Israel relations, to the dramatic shifts we're seeing in global labor and tech markets, largely driven by China's competitive fury and India's unique AI boom.
It really is a landscape defined by contested facts and, well, shifting foundations. And if we circle back one last time to Steven Pinker's concept of common knowledge, that idea that the key to societal trust and complex coordination is knowing what others know, we have to ask a final, maybe provocative question, especially regarding all the domestic turmoil we discussed earlier.
Okay, what's the question?
If that core social assumption, that shared reality, is our foundation, what happens when powerful entities, whether it's governments manipulating administrative rules, media outlets capitalizing on partisan violence, or maybe big tech companies obscuring financial realities, what happens when they spend so much energy actively distorting, manipulating, or maybe just outright denying that common knowledge?
When the shared facts themselves become thoroughly contested and polarized.
Exactly. It puts immense, possibly even fatal strain on the stability of societies, on democracy itself. It's a dark thought, perhaps, to explore regarding the future of stable democracies, but one that feels absolutely essential to understanding the currents of this very volatile age we're living through.
A critical thought indeed, and one for you, our listeners, to continue mulling over. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dives.
Continue your exploration, stay curious, and we'll catch you next time.